The Benlli Pwaii Museum podcast, from where the Battle of Britain was won. Hello, and welcome back to the Benlli Pwaii Museum podcast. My name is Alex, and I'm joined by Tim. So it's great to be back again. It's been just over a year now since we last released an episode, although I just want to say a massive thank you to everyone who has still been listening and streaming the previous episodes over the course of 2023. But now we are back, and today we will be talking with artist Paul Joyce. Now, you may know Paul as a war artist. He is currently holding a temporary exhibition here at Benlli Pwaii Museum, called A Remembrance of War. The exhibition is a collection of striking paintings depicting scenes from World War II. Our podcast historian, Tim, had the chance to catch up with him just before the opening of the exhibition last year to hear some of the inspiration behind his work and the intent for the exhibition.
Hello, Paul.
Hello to you, sir.
Nice to be talking to you today.
Likewise.
If you would then, Paul, before we talk about your art in the upcoming exhibition, would you like to take us back to the young Paul? When were you born, Paul, and what sort of circumstances?
I was born in 1940. I was born really at the start of the war, December 1940, just missed Christmas Day by a day or two. My mother was in Winchester Hospital, I think, surrounded by air raids and the usual, you know. I mean, my memories start really from about 42, 43 up till the end of the war when we moved back to London.
Yeah.
Because my father was an executive, a senior executive with the Bank of England, and he was very keen to enlist and to fight. And they refused to let him because they said he was more valuable with the bank. The bank was, of course, in the building that we all know and see constantly whenever the interest rates go up. There's enough. So he worked there, but they moved a whole department down to Whitchurch, which is somewhere between Andover and Basingstoke. We were domiciled in the vicarage at Whitchurch, courtesy of the lovely vicar and his wife. Gert and Bert were the names. And Gertrude, Bertram. And one day I said, Gert and Bert, much to their chagrin and to my parents' embarrassment. So we were under the roof of Gert and Bert, and the bank established a temporary base in a wonderful forest, which I still recall. And, you know, my interest in trees, I think, goes back to wandering through and towards these Nissen huts in the forest where the bank had set up their operations. So that was the background to why I was in Whitchurch during the war.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, clearly you were very young at the time. Have you any personal recollection of the conflict?
Yes, I have. There was constant noise of planes. The garden of the vicarage had a trout stream running through it. And I remember a bomb nearby sort of threw trout out, you know, flopping onto the bank. It was that close sometimes. That was the only one that was really close. But the obscene thing about what the Nazis were doing at that time, and there wasn't a great deal of publicity about it, although we were warned because we were the victims of it, they sent shiny objects, which would appeal to young people like me, you know, to investigate them and pick them up and so on. And they were actually bombs, you know, they were anti-personnel weapons. Some landed in the garden and Gert and Bert called the authorities. And I remember the lorry came in and they took them away very carefully. But I thought that was, even then, I thought that was, you know, underhand, you know, that's not really in the Geneva Convention, is it?
No, I don't think so. And it's interesting, you know, to a young person at the time. And it, I think, strangely, they were called butterfly bombs, which...
Yes, I suppose because of the way they kind of came down like a seed from an ash tree or something like that. Yeah. Yes, they looked a bit... Well, I suppose they were meant to really look like other things than they were.
Yeah, it implies an innocence that wasn't there.
Well, was Hitler ever an innocent baby boy? I think my distress over Hitler, apart from, you know, what he got up to, he wanted to be, and indeed considered himself to be, an artist, which I thought demeaned, you know, the title, the nomenclature that I like to put myself under. I don't really want to be alongside adults. Watercolour studies, you know.
Yes, it gives a whole new meaning to the term war artist, doesn't it?
indeed, yes. So there were crashed planes and fields, which will form part of the show, vapor trails and dogfights, and the Americans arriving. That was my first experience of chewing gum. They arrived in Whitchurch in open lorries, you know, in fine form. And we sort of chased along behind them, and they'd lob out sticks of chewing gum to them. I suppose it would have been, if I'd been 16, it would have been cigarettes, you know, but for us, it was chewing gum. So, you know, those are some of the things that come back to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting and helps set a context for the discussion. I mean, at some point then, possibly, presumably post-war, your father moves back to London. Yes. Any recollections of that time?
Well, yes. I mean, London, post-war London, I mean, A, there were so few cars around then, you could play in the street. I spent most of the time in the garden in the street, and just you'd go across the street without even looking, because if a car came, it was noisy enough for you to hear it, and you know it was twice an hourly event. This was Sydenham, South London, near Crystal Palace, which had already been burned to the ground in '36 anyway. So it was a bomb site, but an even worse one. And I grew up in wild places like that. Sydenham Wells Park around the corner was similarly a wild sort of garden type, what would be called a wilding place now. And you never saw a park keeper, never saw one. So you could do what you liked, you know, it's great. Every street had gaps where the houses were, every street. And there was still rubble. You know, we played in the rubble. And you found ordnance there, empty shells, and you had to be very careful, obviously. We could have blown ourselves up, I suppose, because of the unexploded mines and so on, but we didn't. And that legacy, of course, led to the dreadful, brutalized architecture of the 50s and 60s. When the material that Hitler inserted into Alderney, into the, particularly the Channel Isles, which I've been to, concrete which will never be able to be removed. So I had mixed feelings of, well, A, I hated the architecture which went out, like the South Bank and Festival Hall and so on. But also it seemed to me to be a Hitlerian material, which I objected to, and still do, actually.
In the catalogue for your exhibition, you talk about the concept of post-memory and the way in which that's influenced your work. Would you like to just explain that concept a little?
Well, my use of that term is to do with the fact that if you live through things, you know, I mean, they say famously that we all remember where we were, those of us who were alive, when JFK was assassinated. It's true. You know, I never met him. I wasn't in Dallas, but that is etched on my memory as if I was there, as indeed was the subsequent assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald just a few hours later. I could do paintings of those because I feel as if I was present. So that's what I'm talking about. And if you think about the images that came out of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, from get-go, from the moment that those bombs were detonated, see things which you'll never forget. And I'm sure that some were and still are censored from us because they're too terrible to contemplate. Again, you know, I wasn't part of that. But as it happens, I managed to obtain a signed photograph of the pilot of the plane that dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima, Paul Tibbets, and I had to think very carefully about whether that should be included in the exhibition. But I'm quite proud to have it because it's a most unusual thing. And also, when you read about Tibbets, you realise he was a very, very substantial commander. He wasn't just some squaddy who was pulled out of the line to fly the plane. You know, he'd accompanied presidents and undertaken carpet bombing of the Japanese islands well before the dropping of the bomb. And at that point, I was thinking of including in the exhibition maybe a little poll at the end, because that will probably be one of the last pictures in the show as you walk around it, saying, what is your attitude, basically, to the bomb, you know? Was Tibbets, by repute, his navigator and co-pilot, turned to him and said, "My God," after the bomb went off, "My God, what have we done?" And, you know, I wanted to know what people thought about that. Seemed to me to be a key question. And it's only recently that I uncovered a fact that had escaped me right up, you know, for decades, which is basically that intelligence reports in 45 had indicated that the Soviet Union then was thinking about a separate invasion of Japan, quite separate from the Allied forces. I think that the authorities were so worried by the prospect of the Soviets, as they did in Germany, not stopping and continuing and then dividing Germany, that they would not stop at the Japanese border. I think probably if I was, you know, in a position of authority in America, able to make a decision about the bomb, at that point I probably would have said, you know, drop it, because that prospect alone would be very worrying, as we subsequently found. So I think all these things are to do with that memory, but, you know, it's not a direct experience, but you live through it. Now, I was very keen for at least one of these pictures, and really as many as they would want to take, should go to the Imperial War Museum, because they hold a collection of unparalleled paintings by really great, great British artists, Graham Sutherland, Henry Moore, Eric Revilius, Paul Nash, John Nash, indeed, his brother, and so on. Not that I would want to put myself in terms of ability with them at all, but just to be alongside them would be enough for me. You know, frankly, I can't imagine there are many artists of my age still interested in that time and creating work.
Yeah. You mentioned two names there, very famous names in the art world, particularly in terms of that period, Paul Nash and Eric Revilius.
Yes.
Have you been influenced by their work?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah? Absolutely. By Nash more than Revilius. I think Revilius's watercolour technique is matchless. And his subject matter was very interesting. He did a whole series of shop fronts and things like that. I mean, you've got to remember these guys, and John Piper too, who I should have mentioned, with people like John Betjeman and so on, they were working for magazines, Lilliput, and, you know, odd, rather questionable publications, doing all sorts of graphic work, which, of course, doesn't happen now, you know. Only a few artists make it, like Hockney, you know, who can do a doodle and it's worth 15,000 or, you know, 50,000 or whatever, you know, just because it's David Hockney makes it valuable. The influence of those artists, and I very much accorded with Kenneth Clark, the great art historian who set up that, the war artist group. And his philosophy was to not show, as we are seeing at the moment in Israel, for example, terrible images of individual distress at a dead baby in your arms, or, you know, news of your son's death or whatever. That was all avoided by the war artists. And I would avoid that too, because it seems to me that the photography took over at that point of, apart from Goya and some of the very great artists of who dealt with things which are unimaginable, really. You have to be Goya to do it. Not Hockney, but you've got Don McCullen. You know, if you've got Don McCullen, you don't need a painter. And what can a painter do in the face of skill and sensitivity like that? You know, a very great artist, McCullen. Not on landscape. Leave the landscape to us, lads, Don. You you go for the war. You know, that the war's fine. That's what you're good at. Displaced persons and so on. A master. At that point, you got those human reactions. I think the aftermath is what I was interested in. You know, so I've one of the a beach at Dunkirk after the Exodus, which is just guns which have been, the barrels of which have been torn apart to render them useless, stacks of rifles, you know, detritus, helmets abandoned. That tells you more, I think, about the activity, because if you took one painting of that, you would be dealing with one squaddy putting one rifle down onto the pile. But if you've got all those different things, your imagination then fires up the people who destroyed the gun, you know, the ones who couldn't get the truck out of the sand and so on. It's rather like the equivalent would be in a radio drama, you know. You hear something, but you put the images, your imagination supplies the images.
Yeah, and that gives you prompts in the mind, questions as deep as, you know, not just what happened here, but why did that happen? What was the experience? Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And Nash, I didn't talk about. He was, I think, one of our greatest artists of the last century, really. He was a war artist for both world wars, and he died before he was 50. And he did magnificent, you know, paintings of planes and surrealist representations of whales and sharks in the air. Surrealist. He was, you know, his skills were not confined in any way. And he's been a great influence. Interestingly, because he was unwell almost all his life, suffering from asthma, which killed him, as far as I know anyway, he never flew. Ravelius was killed in a plane, lost somewhere in the Arctic on a reconnaissance, a secret reconnaissance, which he was obviously attending. No, gone, disappeared. Nash was desperate to get into a plane, never did. He had one appointment booked, and he arrived at the airfield and something was wrong. Either he had an asthma attack or the weather was against it. So he never got into a cockpit, but he was obsessed. And his great, great picture of the Battle of Britain, which is in the Imperial War Museum, is from an aerial view looking down towards the Channel. So in his mind, he was flying all the time.
Mm. Mm. We've talked about your own experiences and that concept of post-memory and the influence upon you of people like, of artists like Nash and Revilius. How has that affected or informed content of paintings and choice of media?
Yes. Revilius was basically a watercolorist, and I wouldn't even begin to try and copy what he did. You know, that's way beyond my skills. Nash worked in all mediums, you know, lithography to prints and so on, woodcuts and watercolors. He was a bit mean with the moolah, was old Nash. And so I'm afraid some of his works have not really stood the test of time too well. I work in oils, acrylics, and occasionally watercolors. I tend to use acrylics now because certainly when I was traveling more, I could bring an acrylic back on a plane, and if it touched something, it wasn't a problem. Whereas you do so at your peril. You have to wait 6 months with a decent oil for it to dry. I don't mind acrylics. Oil is a much, I wouldn't say it's a kind of medium. It's much more sort of tactile and sensual, because you can run it about and mix it. And you can, if you get tired, you can come back the next day. And it, you know, if you get tired and come back the next day with acrylic, you know, you need a chisel to get it off the. I think oil is, if you want things to last for forever, or as long as the canvas or the wood supporting it does, use oil. Acrylic's the next best and very practical, you know. Although painting outside with acrylics, they dry even quicker, you know, and that can be a huge disadvantage, you know. You need to think, you know, this is a quick sketch of my son. Well, then, you know, a 3 or 4B pencil is fine. This is the view of my garden in the spring. Well, then you need color, don't you? That could be watercolor or oil or acrylic, you know, or pastel, for example. You know, I think the great thing about the technology we're dealing with today is that the internet can bring you all those things, you know.
Yeah.
And masterclasses, Bob Ross, painting, you know, start there and move on, you know.
Yeah.
It's all there.
Yep.
And I have to say that the internet was very helpful when I was trying to get jog my memory, you know. There are a lot of historical photographs, and I would pay a debt to the to Wikipedia and to the people who you know, put those together.
Brilliant. That's a nice explanation. We've talked about the background, essentially, your background, the way in which your thinking and approach to art has developed, the influences that you've had in artistic terms. If we think now specifically about the exhibition at Bentley Priory Museum, you've got quite a wide range of work there in the exhibition. Is there any work in particular that has meaning or resonance for you, particular meaning or resonance for you, that you maybe would particularly like visitors to the exhibition to take in?
I think the after effects of the bomb, of the Hiroshima bomb, there are two that I recall. I think I painted them more or less the same time. There's one of a child's tricycle, which has been, clearly the child had been playing on it near the epicenter of the blast, and it's the remains of this tricycle with all the paintwork stripped off and so on. Looking at that, you can imagine what the bomb would do to flesh. So that's one. Almost the same time, and again within I think 500 meters of the epicenter, was a theatre building. You know, I have directed in the theatre, and you know, I have an affection for the performing arts and for culture. I looked at the after effects from a number of angles, film and photography of the time, and I could see that the the skeleton of the building looked like a crouching dog. So it looked to me like, you know, a dog cowering under threat or, you know, fearful. Also slightly upstanding and defiant. And I thought that was, there was a nice kind of irony there. The other one is the, there's a painting which is heavily influenced by Nash, which is, his is Totes Mare, the Dead Sea, which is, I think, in near Oxford, there was a dumping ground for wrecked planes, which he eloquently painted. And I've done my version of that, which is slightly, no, I wouldn't say more complicated, but a bit more detailed, a picture of Hitler on one of the planes. Someone said, you know, famously, as we know, the devil is in the detail. Well, I've got horns when it comes to painting detail.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation for me, Paul. Forever, never the artist, I'm afraid. I don't think I'll ever make an artist. It's been a pleasure to talk to a real artist and to learn something about the influences on the artist, how they draw from their own experience, from other people's experience, from the things they see around them as they grow, the ways in which other artists have worked and making choices about media to use to get the concept and the feeling across. And also that, I think, really important aspect that I learned about, which is the meaning, looking for the meaning which the artist has tried to put into the painting or work of art, and to reflect on what you see and think about the questions it prompts, like why, what, who, what was the experience? So I've learned a lot, Paul, in this discussion. Thank you for giving us your time. And I hope our listeners, very much hope our listeners, will visit the exhibition and see what they can draw from that experience and take away for them. Brilliant, Paul. Thank you very much indeed for this conversation. It's been great.
So my pleasure. And for visitors who do go, there's going to be a visitor's book. I'd much appreciate comments. Just one other thing, if I might just put a coda on. Very often paintings have hidden meanings, which audiences might latch onto subconsciously. I'd just like to mention one, which is towards the end of the exhibition, there's a painting of the Enola Gay, which was the enormous American aircraft. B-59, was it? Or
B-29.
B-29, which became, they did something like a Stratocruiser out of it later, which was the size of the Empire State Building. Anyway, this painting doesn't show Paul Tibbets the pilot or the bomb. It's just basically the plane in flight. But the subject matter there are the rivets. You can barely count the rivets in the painting. There are so many. Because I wanted to put together what was the most sophisticated bomb ever made into a piece of metal, which was held together by the same rivets, or the same manufacture indeed, and design of rivets that Isambard Kingdom Brunel used on the Great Eastern 150 years before. The rivets are carrying this astonishing bomb, 3,000 bombs.
Brilliant. That's a brilliant way to end this, Paul. Thank you.
With that, the temporary exhibition, A Remembrance of War, has been extended due to its success until Saturday, the 29th of June. So if you haven't been to see Paul's work, you still have an abundance of time to do so. Or, of course, if you have been already, maybe it's worth a revisit to reflect on the conversation in this podcast and look at the work in a new light. The museum is now back open after the winter break on Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays, and the current temporary exhibition is included in the admission price. I hope you have enjoyed this episode, and Tim and I hope to bring you new episodes throughout this coming year. But for now, thank you for listening and take care.